right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and that was Let There Be Drums from Sandy Nelson. And I hope by this time that when people hear that, they turn it way up and just get completely energized, because that's what I do every time I hear it. In fact, they have to send people to come in. You can hear it now. See that? You have to send people in to pull me away and put me down in the seat, strap me into the seat so I can start the show and start talking to people. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with journalist Dave Lindorf about the constitutional crimes of Barack Obama. That's right, Obama and the gang. We'll be digging into that, what the hell they're doing. Before that, we'll be spending a little bit of time, just a brief visit from Lily Hayden, violinist, vocalist, composer, guitarist, and actress, and she'll be joining us to debut a new song she has out, and she doesn't have it out yet. It's part of an album that will be out, but we're going to be talking about a whole lot of stuff with her, and she will be coming back next week, next Friday, to spend a half an hour with us talking about her work. But opening the show up, I wanted to, I'm really happy to have my next guest, and that's my first guest, actually, Henry Giroux. And I found Henry's article, Violence USA, The Warfare State and the Brutalizing of Everyday Life, on Truthout. And Henry's one of the founding theorists of critical pedagogy in the U.S., and he serves as the Global TV Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. And the article itself was something that really grabbed my attention, because if you're at all concerned and you look out, if you're at all awake in the deepest sense of being awake, and you look out at the society we live in, you've really got to question and seriously question what's going on in this society. How is it linked to the terrible things that are going on in the world? How is this linked to the fact that the world is a horror? And why is it a horror? And Henry has produced an article that I thought really digs into and poses some very important questions and ideas. So let's jump into it right away. Henry, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Sure. Well, you know, in your article, which again, I mean, I read it a lot since I first found it, and because it provokes so much in terms of the kind of society we're living in. And you talk about how since 9/11, the boundaries between the realms of war and civil life have collapsed, and that the metaphysics of war and associated violence now creep into everyday life. All right, Henry, what the hell are you talking about there?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I'm trying to say in a piece is that war really has become almost the supreme national value. I mean, what has happened in the United States is that it not only is a matter of policy affecting what we would call foreign affairs, war actually becomes a mediating force that begins to seep into almost every aspect of daily life. We see it with its logics of cruelty and punishment. We see it seeping into a whole range of institutions. I mean, as I say in the piece, I mean, increasingly we see schools being modeled after prisons. We see police forces becoming paramilitarized. We see popular culture endlessly celebrating the spectacle of violence. So it's become like an electric current that we simply can't get away from. It becomes a defining organizing principle that becomes one of the few shared mediating forces that now hold almost what I would call everyday life together. So I'm really concerned in this piece about the sort of formative culture that actually produces the celebration and spectacle of violence.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to get into a lot of that as we go along. I wanted to also talk, though, you talk about something that you're calling a permanent warfare state. And I do think, you know, one of the things that's become very increasingly clear to anybody who is honestly watching what's going on in the world and what the U.S. is doing in the world, that there is a permanent state of war on the world, launched by the U.S., fought by the U.S., and you know, it's really trying to establish this, like, globally unchallenged and unchallengeable empire. And you talk about this being a permanent warfare state and the consequences of that. Can we talk about that? Why do you see it as a permanent warfare state, and what are some of the consequences?
Well, I mean, the consequences is that we spread death and destruction all over the globe in the name of advancing democracy. I mean, the hypocrisy that sort of formulation sort of in some way takes, the way in which it takes place, is almost overwhelming. But I also claim that the United States is a permanent warfare state because of not only the war that it wages, the wars that it wages abroad, illegal, immoral, and unjustifiable, but also the war that it wages on women, on workers, and on youth. Even the lexicon that we use in the United States, I mean, Southern senators talking about how we now live in a, you know, the domestic front has become a battleground in order to justify the some of these policies that we're now instituting under Obama that abridge civil liberties, the national the National Defense Authorization Act. So I think that the consequences are terrible. I mean, I think that what we have to ask ourselves is are a number of questions. One, what are the social costs of having a permanent war state? Who does it benefit, and what are the consequences in terms of the massive destruction that it reproduces? What effects does it have on policy at home? How does it become a tool for governance? How does it function as an ideology? How does it become central to a massive cultural apparatus that now uses violence as the ultimate form of entertainment?
You know, And one of the things that just to go back to the beginning of your comment there, in terms of this unleashing this horror on the world, you know, one of the things that when you pose that and you talk about the mushrooming of war crimes committed by U.S. troops these days, which I don't, you know, it's really sickening. And every time you think it can't get worse, it does, you know, from the urinating on bodies to taking pictures with the body parts, you know, soldiers taking pictures with the body parts to all the kinds of things that are happening. Even the mindless killing and remorseless killing, the fact that you've unleashed a whole army of remorseless killers on the world and they celebrate this thing. But you also, when you're talking there, and I found this very interesting because you make a point that this is not new. Mind-numbing violence isn't new. The U.S. has done this for, you know, almost as long as it's been around. You know, when you look at what it's done to the native people here, when you look at what it did, you know, the dropping of the atom bombs, the, you know, all the kind of savagery it's unleashed all around the world. You know, that's not new. You know,
actually, that's true. I say there's a long history of these kinds of savage acts, but I think that what is new is the way in which two things are new. The way in which this violence is now normalized in the culture. It's everywhere. It's aligned with almost every public institution, and it is the product of what some authors have called punishment creep, how modes of punishment, a kind of hyper-punitiveness, now begins to creep into a whole range of institutions unlike anything we've seen in the past. But I also think that there's something else that you're getting at that really needs to be said. It operates in the image of reality TV, this world, you know, all against all. It seems to me that we constantly are upping the ante around the spectacle of violence. And I think that we, in some way, have arrived at that point where the only thrill we have left is not just simply engaging in violence, but in some way engaging in the most ruthless and savage forms of violence in order to get the ultimate thrill. I mean, when you look at what happened in Afghanistan with the kill team, I mean, it's not enough to humiliate anymore. I mean, the ultimate act of mediation that violence now performs is actually committing the most unbelievable degradations on human life. And that's scary. I mean, I find that element of pumped-up hyper-punitiveness and violence, it not only deadens the soul and hardens any sense of compassion, but it seems to me it makes murder more than simply entertainment. It makes it a sport.
Yeah, you know, and that's important. And actually, you point out something that really struck me in terms of the kind of the creation of this kind of culture. And it is really troubling because, you know, I was a friend of mine who's a young guy. He's, you know, was just out of college a few years back, and he was looking at YouTube, and he called me over, and he wanted to show me something he thought was just hilarious, and it was this, whatever it was some woman out in the country singing on a band. She was singing some kind of, you know, backward song or something. She was up on a stage, and it was done in a grape squashing. They were like squashing grapes with dance, you know, dancing in a barrel squashing grapes, and suddenly the stage collapsed, and this woman was very seriously hurt. But the person that was showing this to me was just this comedic sense that he found in the suffering of this woman, you know, that I just couldn't. And it's a minor example when you compare it to what you're talking about, what's happening in the world. But the idea that from the most mundane examples of violence and suffering of people to the most horrible, we have, in fact, we're living in a culture that exactly as you say, has normalized all this and embraced it. It's really, really disturbing.
You know, I mean, violence and death, well, now it brings cheers to the American public.
Yeah.
It's now celebrated as the ultimate form of entertainment. I mean, I love your example because I think it's in the small change of everyday life that you really begin to see how powerful these kinds of things work. You know, as I mentioned in my piece, I mean, even when Susan, my wife, and I saw Hunger Games the other night, and, you know, one could argue that it, in some way it's a critique of some kind of dystopian society that's gone mad. But the other side of this is that, you know, I mean, you rarely see any critiques of this film based on the enormous kinds of violence that takes place in it against youth and against children. And I think that when we talk about the violence of everyday life and people gaining satisfaction from it rather than being appalled by it, we have to ask ourselves, what is it about this society that is creating and reinforcing, distributing and circulating this culture of cruelty? Where does it come from? And part of it comes from the fact that all of a sudden we live in a society marked by what some have called a failed sociality. I mean, we have no language for democracy. We have no language for compassion. We view any form of dependency, any form of regard for the other as humiliating. We live in a neoliberal market-driven culture that basically celebrates self-interest. It celebrates narcissism. It celebrates celebrity culture. And it views the news as a joke, a source of entertainment. So it's really not surprising in the lack of any kind of formative culture that would celebrate social relationships that have a sense of compassion and regard for the other that we end up with this. This is a kind of fascist aesthetic. I mean, and I don't say that lightly, because I think that what it does, it allows people to cling to the assumption that certain groups in this society, as the social state is being dismantled by these right-wingers, are utterly disposable and represent excess. And as such, they can be taken care of. They can be eliminated in any way possible, whether we put them in prisons, whether we put them in asylums, or whether we kill them abroad, or whether we just kidnap them and assassinate them. I mean, we're at a very, very dire moment in our history around this question of violence and how it's become the supreme, ultimate form of glue, sort of both entertaining and holding the society together.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't agree more. And let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Henry Giroux. Henry's one of the founding theorists of critical pedagogy in the United States, and he serves as the Global TV Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University. He is the author of more than 50 books and over 300 academic articles, including his most recent work, The University in Chains, Confronting the Military-Industrial Academic Complex, which actually we're going to get into in a little bit in terms of the way that plays into this whole situation we're talking about. You know, one thing I was thinking, though, about this point about the creation of this kind of culture, you know, you raise a point that I thought was very, very interesting, and especially for someone like me who doesn't follow sports a whole lot. But you raised the point around the New Orleans Saints, and I thought that, you know, because you look at this and really the convergence of insane, mindless, you know, patriarchy, patriotism, and utter war-inspired violence. And what's going on with the New Orleans Saints was just an incredible example. I thought really should shock the hell out of people.
No, it's unbelievable. I mean, what I love about that example is that...
You should tell people what the example is, actually.
The example is that the New Orleans Saints, one of the coaches for the Saints, actually was paying players what he called a bounty to actually injure other players who were crucial for them to win the game. Players who were basically stars, or players who were playing well, or players who represented a threat to the possibility of the Saints losing the game. Can you imagine? Paid him a bounty of $1,500 to seriously injure another player. And I think that what struck me about that example was not just the utter sheer ruthlessness of it. I mean, my God, I mean, to inflict that kind of injury on another human being in the name of sport, but how that ideology aligns with so many other institutions in the culture. So that the question is not, wow, isn't that crazy? The question is, how is it that something like that can happen given the fact that it's being normalized everywhere else? I mean, that ideology aligns with so many institutions, whether you're talking about reality TV or whether you're talking about the onslaught of endless shows on crime or whether you're talking about the rise of the punishing state or whether you're talking about schools and now as models for prisons. I mean, that logic is everywhere. So it's not surprising that we see this creeping endlessly into places where we wouldn't expect it.
Yeah. You know, and one of the things, places where we wouldn't expect it, Think about this. We're told day in and day out, and I mean here out in California, you know, there's endless examples of, and it's all over the country. You know, I was just reading an article on guns in the New Yorker, and they were talking about how many guns are owned by, I think there's apparently something like one gun for every person in the U.S., you know, that's actually the number of guns that are in circulation. Yeah, okay, 9 out of 10. Something you should be pretty concerned about. But they're also the whole way that gets portrayed, too, is not that the culture that produces this thing, but actually that there's something inherent, and in particular in relation to youth. And one of the areas that you concentrate on in the article, and I think in your work to a certain degree, too, is that what's happening with youth? And, you know, conventional wisdom tells us that the schools are a mess, they're a nest of potential killers, juvenile criminals, psychopaths, and sociopaths that have to be tightly controlled. But you actually get into a pedagogy of brutalizing hardness and dehumanization that's produced and circulated in schools, boot camps, prisons, and other sites. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, no, thank you, Michael. That's a great question. I mean, especially for the work I'm doing. I mean, one of the things that I have been very concerned about in the last decade is that while the left particularly talks about women, talks about race, talks about gender, talks about class, they really talk about young people. And it seems to me that what we're witnessing in the United States, unlike almost at any other time in its history, is what I call the soft war and the hard war on youth. The soft war is simple. It's the war of utter commercialization, where young people are simply turned into commodities or actually are useful only for buying commodities. But the hard war is something else. The hard war is the punishing war. The hard war means that an increasing number of young people, particularly poor minorities of race and class, are being subjected increasingly to the what I call the tentacles of the criminal justice system. And you see this in many, many sites, from malls to schools, but particularly in schools. I mean, what we have now is we have zero tolerance policies that are just basically nothing more than vehicles for what we call the school-to-prison pipeline. Young black and brown and white poor kids are being thrown out of schools. They're being basically put in the arms of the criminal justice system for infractions that are mind-blowing. I mean, I read a story yesterday about a six-year-old girl, 6 years old, who was handcuffed because she threw a temper tantrum in her kindergarten class. The school called in the police to deal with her. Can you imagine? I mean, young people now are being criminalized, their behaviors are being criminalized because they violate dress codes. I mean, the school has basically become an adjunct of the criminal justice system. And I think that we have to ask ourselves, you know, what is it about young people that has allowed this country to see them as nothing more than a public pathology? I mean, why is it that all of a sudden those institutions that should nourish and cherish and invest in children now basically punish them? We no longer have a war on poverty. We have a war on the poor. You know, we no longer have an educational system that educates. It now criminalizes. And to get back to your comment about gun culture and young people, I don't know if you know this, but you know that every year 20,000 children under the age of 20 are killed by firearms in the United States. I mean, that figure alone should raise questions about the predominance of violence and this insidious National Rifle Association and its gun culture in the United States. But we barely get a bleep on the radar over this issue.
Yeah, no kidding, man. Let me remind listeners that we're talking with Henry Giroux, and he's the author of the article Violence USA, The Warfare State and the Brutalizing of Everyday Life, which you can find on Truthout. And he's holds the Global TV Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. Now, Henry, one of the things that, you know, as you're speaking, I kept thinking about, you know, my experience. I remember the first time I went into a high school here in Los Angeles, and it was down in Watts, and I walked in, and a friend of mine was teaching there, and she was under fire constantly because she refused to let the school security randomly search her students' bags, come into the classroom and randomly search her students' bags for contraband. And, you know, when I walked around the school, I noticed that there was a video camera. There was no spot in the school that you were not under surveillance by video cameras. And, you know, and it became, you know, basically it became, and here's what the authorities used to do, the principal and whatnot. They used to roll dice in the morning or roll a die, and whatever, if it came up 1 to 6, whatever number came up, they would go to every room that had that number in it. Like if it was 103 and the number was 3, they'd go to 203 or 302 or whatever. They'd just go there and do these random searches. And then they would, you know, basically arrest people, arrest these kids, seize the contraband, kick them out of school, all this other stuff. So this point about being in a cell block was really, really driven home to people. And you make the point that there's this sort of combination of the militarization of the schools and the privatization of the schools informs each other and has real concrete effects. I mean, in terms of society, you talk about stunting the ability to have critical thinking. And then also this point about you creating a situation where, as you were just saying, the people, especially oppressed nationalities and poor, think that they're better off in jail than they are in school.
I mean, what's interesting about that link between militarization and privatization is, remember, you know, there was a time, you know, I think I'm older than you, Michael, but in my generation, when schools were seen as a public good, they weren't just seen as a matter of private interest and a private good. And I think we've completely flipped that script. And in flipping that script, what has often happened is that the governing principle that now organizes schools is basically about de-skilling teachers. It's about making students stupid by educating them simply to take tests. It's about punishing those students that are seen as disposable. It's about basically defining schools as sites of containment. It's about seeing them as ultimately sites of profit. And it's about completely eliminating any association between the purpose of schooling and the imperatives of a democracy. The language of democracy has been completely ripped from the discourse of school reform. We no longer use that language. The language now is about efficiency, training workers, punishing students, and so forth and so on. And so I think that what we have here, and I think that what's interesting about this discussion today is that, you know, we live in a country in which you have the emergence of what I call the punishing state, because the social state is being dismantled. And the only thing left for the state to do is to either work in cahoots with finance capital in order for it to do everything that it can to make as much money as possible, and to contain those populations, those elements, and those individuals who basically oppose a threat to its ideology, its logic, its basic logics, and its organizing principles. So, I mean, the state has so little role left in promoting the public good that the only thing that we now see is a massive emergence of police power and the militarization of everyday life in society. And we see it, for instance, in the way in which the police are now coming down on the peaceful Occupy movements. I mean, here are young people. What are they against? They're against inequality and greed. They protest and they get maced. I mean, what's the message here about what democracy means in this country in light of those kinds of violent actions?
Yeah, exactly. In fact, that was a point I was going to get into with you, was the militarization of the police. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you look at that and it really is, you know, even the way the police conduct themselves, just, you know, as you said, coming up against Occupy, I mean, they become these things that you once at one point, you know, and they've always played a certain role in relation to the state. But now this conscious, you know, cloaking them as sort of the Darth Vaders, you know, who, and really inspiring, trying to inspire fear and terror in people on the basis of this militarization, which is very real when you look at the surveillance, the firepower they have.
The line between the military, the actual military, the armed forces, and, of course, the police is collapsing, as we all know, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, not only do they now dress up and use technologies and weapons that are completely out of line for being used domestically, I mean, if not abroad, to say the least, but they also become a model for a new kind of vigilantism in the United States. I mean, in the sense that that kind of police presence, that emphasis on force, really becomes in some way a model for allowing other groups on the right, particularly, to act in a similar fashion. You know, I mean, think about Trayvon Martin. I mean, this kid who, this young, beautiful black boy, who all of a sudden becomes a criminal because he's cutting through what, a gated community, a community based exclusively on the notions of exclusion and personal security, and we allow civilians who mimic the police to shoot and kill people like this, and we actually make it legal by virtue of the laws that are being imposed. I mean, this is not good, and I think it's an index of the growing authoritarianism that we see in the United States.
And it's also, and I know you have to run real quick, but let's try and get one more question. You can squeeze your answer tight. I'll squeeze my question quick. You talk about it in Standing Up Against All This. You talk about how there should be cultural apparatuses that could be key in creating and shaping an informed and engaged people, but they've unfortunately become little more than market-driven and militarized knowledge factories. But you also cite Stanley Aronowitz saying something that I thought was very important, and that is that the system survives on the eclipse of the radical imagination, the absence of a viable political opposition with roots in the general population, and the conformity of its intellectuals. And in the face of that, you pose that we need something that goes beyond even the idea of having a grammar of political disobedience. Can we talk about that a little?
Oh, yeah, I think there are a couple of things quickly. I mean, I think we really need to recognize that education is a central political force. I mean, you have to change consciousness in order to change behavior. I mean, I believe that reason in that sense counts. And the left has, and I think progressives in general, have ignored the notion that pedagogy should be central to any viable notion of politics. They just ignored it. And I think that, secondly, we need to work and create the public spheres, alternative or otherwise, where we can basically challenge much of the militarization, much of the neoliberalism, the market-driven culture, this global insanity that we now see surrounding us. But we have to do it in ways that connect to everyday lives. Thirdly, we have to have social movements. I mean, we cannot rely on a two-party movement that basically is in bed with each other. We need social movements, and we need to refigure the terrain of politics, and we need to, in some way, find a language coupled with the incentive to create those organizations that can change this political landscape. Capitalism and democracy are not the same thing. They are not the same thing. And I think that what we need to do is to look at these countries abroad who are now fighting for the promise of democracy, not its existing reality, and ask ourselves, what do we need to do individually and collectively in every institution that we find ourselves to sort of change that narrative?
All right, Henry, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for inviting me.
Sure, and let's stay in touch, and we'll have you back on again, okay?
Okay,
all right, bye-bye. Take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Henry Giroux, and we've been talking about his article, Violence USA, The Warfare State and the Brutalizing of Everyday Life.